All right. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to hour number two of Christian Worldview with Dr. Tony Beam. Thanks for joining us. We're cranking it up for hour number two. This is Tony Beam, Director of Church and Community Engagement for the Tim Brazier Campus of North Greenville University, where Christ makes the difference and where we are equipping transformational leaders for the church and society. I also serve as the Director of the Office of Public Policy for the South Carolina Baptist Convention. And I've been blessed to be able to serve as interim pastor in a number of locations, currently wrapping up an interim pastorate position at Impact Church over in Spartanburg. Their new pastor is going to start December 4th. I was just talking to him yesterday, and I'm excited about Dave Carroll coming up from Florida to be part of our community and becoming the pastor at Impact. We're also excited this morning to have Senator Shane Massey with us on the program. Senator Massey was elected from District 25 to the Senate in 2007, and he was elevated to Majority Leader in 2016, I believe, and he serves in that role today in the South Carolina Senate. Good morning, Senator. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Tony. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. Let me ask you to talk to our listeners a little bit. What is the position of Majority Leader? What does that mean for the Senate? What is your leadership role like there among the other senators?
Well, I think it sounds a whole lot more influential than it really is. it's the chief cat herder. But I think I followed Harvey Peeler, who did a great job in that role, and
right,
kind of set the example. Because really, we've only had three Republican majority leaders, because Republicans took control of the Senate in 2001, and so I've approached it as one in which I need to have a good rapport with all the Republican senators, and it's not with all the senators, but especially with the Republican senators, and just try to stay in touch with them and try to figure out where they are on different things, and I try to help drive the agenda, and then I'm very involved on the floor once legislation comes to the floor,
right,
trying to develop the strategy and the game plan on how to get it passed. So there's a lot to it.
Yeah, talking about the strategy, obviously, we had Roe versus Wade overturned, which was a thunderclap culturally and politically in our country. And South Carolina responded by the House setting up an ad hoc committee that put together the skeleton of what would become H-5399. It made its way through the House, ended up with some amendments. But in the basic bill would protect a baby in the womb from conception. And, of course, that goes further than the heartbeat bill that was passed back in 2021. The heartbeat bill is essentially a six-week bill. And the House bill that came out this summer as part of a sine-die resolution that gave the legislature the ability to come back and consider this, it came out with amendments for rape and incest and went over to the Senate. And the Senate made some adjustments, actually ending up in striking and inserting language that pretty much made it a version of the heartbeat bill, sent it back. House didn't concur. It goes back to the Senate. It goes to conference. And last week, it pretty much just came to an end because a compromise could not be reached in the conference committee. So could you give us your take on what happened in this whole process, that after a long process of trying to find a way to get some protections added for life in South Carolina, the legislature was unable to do it?
Yeah, well, you gave a very good summary there, procedural summary of how things worked out. I'll try to give you a little bit of some background information on how things played out as well. And I'll say, first of all, I have been, I've talked about this privately, but I support a ban on abortion from the time that a mother's pregnant, right? I support the exceptions for rape and incest and life of the mother, but that's where I hoped that we were going to be able to go. And in fact, that's where I hoped, even up until the last day of the Senate debate in September, that's where I thought we had a really good shot at getting.
Right.
But yeah, so the House wanted to take the lead. That's fine with me. So they started the ad hoc committee, and they came up with the language. Now, I think everybody understood that what the House passed was going to be a difficult sell in the Senate. And I say everybody understood that because, you know, we had the debate on heartbeat last year. I mean, as you mentioned, it was 2021. It was early 2021. But the Senate makeup is essentially the same as it was in 2021. We've had one difference because of a death and a special election. But that doesn't impact our votes. If anything, it probably helps our votes. So the Senate makeup is the same, and we had the debate. And so I had a pretty good idea based on that debate about where senators were. So it goes through the process. We come to the Senate in early September, and it had been changed some in committee and then on the floor beforehand. And so I put up an amendment to that would do what you and I just talked about. It would prohibit abortions from the moment that a woman can be diagnosed as being pregnant. I thought going into that, I knew it was going to be real close, but I thought I had a shot. And it turns out that we were just short. Now, we did get 24 votes, which is a majority of the body. We didn't have enough votes to overcome the filibuster.
Right. There were six Republicans that joined the Democrats in filibustering that. Yeah.
Yep, there were six Republicans. So, because we have 30 Republicans in the chamber, so we had 24 votes for that. We didn't get any Democratic votes for that legislation. Now, I also think it's important to point out that five of those six Republicans were, I mean, they were instrumental in passing the fetal heartbeat law the year before.
Right.
One of those six, Senator Tom Davis, actually chaired the subcommittee and led the effort on the floor to get heartbeat passed. So these are not, I mean, in my view at least, five of these six are clearly not pro-abortion Republicans, right? Because they all supported prohibiting abortion once a fetal heartbeat is detected. We actually picked up a Democrat last year on the heartbeat law, so the final vote count, we had 30 for that. But we lost six Republicans on my amendment. And, you know, and probably for a little bit different reasons for each one of them. But if there was a common sense there, it was that there was some real unease about, for some of them, going earlier than 6 weeks. For some of them also, some of them who I thought that I had a real chance of picking up their votes, the rhetoric that had gone on before my amendment came up really turned some people away. So what we did ultimately is when we found out we couldn't pass that, at that point, the Supreme Court, the South Carolina Supreme Court, had enjoined the heartbeat law. They issued that order. It was a fairly detailed order. So what I wanted to do at the very least was protect heartbeat. I didn't want to risk losing heartbeat because the effect of that would have been to go back to 20 weeks, which is, I guess, because of the injunction, is the current state of the law now.
Right.
I definitely didn't want to do that. I mean, and we've seen what the results are of that. So we ultimately had the votes to pass something to fix the issue that the court identified in heartbeat. And actually, we even strengthened it some.
Might you add a provision that would have made it to where state employees could not use their state-provided insurance to have an abortion? You added a provision that defunded Planned Parenthood permanently from the state budget. But it also added an amendment that I believe was addressed fatal fetal anomaly, that if you had two physicians who stated that a baby could not survive outside the womb, that the woman would not be forced to carry that baby to term if the baby was not going to live outside the womb. I think those were the main differences, right?
Well, and if you recall, the fatal fetal anomaly language was part of the heartbeat
Right.
bill when it passed last
right,
year.
Right, right, right. So, yeah, that's correct.
But what we did was to, we limited the time limit on rape and incest exceptions, whereas currently it's unlimited. We limited that back to the first trimester.
Yeah, 12 weeks, I think.
Yeah, we required stronger language to ensure that if there was a rape, if there was a crime committed, that there would be evidence that could help law enforcement pursue and prosecute the criminal. So there were definitely efforts to make heartbeat stronger than what it was, but then also to fix the efforts that the court identified. And we had a strong number of Republicans. I think we had 28 votes to do that. I didn't want to go home without, at the very least, fixing those problems. I wanted to go further. We tried to do that, but at the very least, we could not leave without doing that.
Yeah,
when it became apparent to me that that's where the votes were, then that's what we did.
I was in the lobby that when all that was going on. I've been there all day, and several other pro-life advocates were there that day. And I remember clearly, I mean, you came out, you had Senator Grooms and Senator Campson with you, and you looked at me, and I remember the look on your face that you were, you said, we're just not going to be able to get this done. And this is, we're going to go back in there and try to get something passed so we don't end up with 20 weeks. But let me ask you a question at this point, because this comes up all the time when I talk to people. They say, okay, you had a filibuster. Why not stay and make them defend the filibuster? Why just give in once the filibuster is announced rather than just stay there until 3 o'clock in the morning if necessary or 4 o'clock in the morning? Make them push the filibuster and break it. So explain what the philosophy is about that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there are different philosophies there. For those of us who have been through filibusters before, the result has always been, in every one that I've been involved in, that you don't pick up votes, you actually lose votes.
Yeah.
We had that scenario in 2000, I think it was 2018, if you remember, we had an abortion bill on the floor, and that was not a pleasant experience at all, because we had to punt on that one entirely, and I did not like that. And I determined that the next time we get this done, I'm going to do a lot of work on the front end, so we're not going to get in that situation again. But you know, we were there after midnight a couple nights, and the final night we were there after midnight into a Friday, which is not normal for us. And what we saw during that effort, even though we were on it for hours and hours, was that not only did we not pick up votes, we actually started losing people.
Yeah.
It was clear to me, part of that was based on some private conversations about, you know, with some of these six, all right, tell me what your concern is, and is there a way that we can fix this? You know, if we add a different exception in there, will you come along with us? And to each senator, it was pretty clear, I think not just to me, but as you indicated, Senator Grooms and Senator Campson, they've been working on life issues for a long time before I was elected even.
Yeah.
It became clear to all of us that we weren't going to get there. And it didn't matter how long you stayed. The only thing that we were going to do was probably you're going to lose some people because they were going to leave.
Right.
You know, if you get up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, you're going to start losing some people. Because if we thought that we could have broken it to the extent that a lot of people suggested, then we would have absolutely done that. But it was clear to us that that wasn't going to happen.
Okay, so the heartbeat, essentially the heartbeat bill that we just described, went over to the House. And the House could either concur or non-concur, and the House voted strong. I think it was like 95-11 to non-concur. So it comes back to the Senate. The Senate can either vote to insist or vote to recede. And to recede would have sent the original House bill, I believe, to the governor. To insist means the Senate says, no, we want our version of the bill so it goes to conference. Now, describe kind of what happened then when we got into the conference.
Yeah, well, first of all, before you get into conference, the recede vote, I mean, part of the problem there was there was a number of concerns in the Senate all along about some of the language in the House bill.
Right.
And I don't want to get too far into the weeds on it, but look, words matter, especially when you know something is likely to be challenged in the courts. You want to make sure that you address the issues that you know are coming up. Part of the issue was as well, the House version, the initial version, did not provide for an exception for fatal fetal anomalies. And as you and I talked about earlier,
right,
when we passed the heartbeat law last year, it included fatal fetal anomalies. And that language was included in the Senate last year during that debate because it was essential in order to get the bill done. So we knew that it was going to have that language. And so there were a number of reasons. There were other reasons as well, but we knew that the vote was not going to be to send the House language to the governor because there was too many concerns with the language,
right,
and what the effects would be. So we get into the conference committee, as you mentioned, and you know, I had a lot of conversations behind the scenes with House members, with other senators, trying to see what we could do and where we could get. And I was pretty straightforward with everybody that look, you know, this is where I see the votes, and I think I do a pretty good job of counting because I talk to people figure out where they are. And plus, we had some votes already, so you could see where people were and what the concerns were. And, you know, there were other people in the conference committee who were insistent that we at least try again for a conception ban. And I'm like, look, I'm okay with that. I'm happy to try. But, you know, you got to be focused on what it actually says. I mean, because every detail on something like this matters.
Right.
Let me just
jump in and say I was at all of the conference committee hearings except for the last one. I didn't make it in time to hear that one, but in every one of them that I was present for, the two that I was present for, I heard you say to the conferees, we don't have the votes to pass this. I mean, you made that clear. And then you know, the compromise came forth from Senator Cash, and this is where when we actually got the conferees to agree, four out of the six, of course, there are two Democrats, they're never going to agree. So the four Republicans agree, two House members, two senators. It gets to the floor, but there are still the same issues that these senators have had since the beginning. And so that's where the breakdown came, and didn't have the votes to pass the compromise. And there were those on a committee who did not want to compromise further. And so that's where the process ended.
That's essentially where the process ended. And look, and we were limited, and this gets really into the procedural weeds. And I don't want to make your listeners fall asleep early in the morning. But you get into some real procedural issues
right here
because but the posture that we were in, we couldn't fix some of those problems in the conference committee, and that was a real problem in trying to get back to something similar to what I proposed in my amendment in September,
right?
To try to get back to a version similar like that where we could have come close. I still think that we wouldn't have had the votes, but I think you could have come close in that scenario. And it didn't happen. And that, you know, that's I know it's disappointing to you because, I mean, you've expressed that to me, and I can also just see it on your face. And it's disappointing to a lot of South Carolinians. It's disappointing to me. I mean, I was frustrated with the whole process. But I don't think I mean, it's over for that bill, but I think there may still be opportunity.
Well, that was going to be my last question. Where do we go from here? Because I know, again,
yeah,
I believe that you want to protect life. And I believe that a lot of senators and majority, the majority of senators, majority of House members want to see that happen. So when we get into January, you think we can we come to some type of resolution here?
Well, again, I'll say, you know, last year on Heartbeat, we had 30 senators, 29 of whom are Republican, voted to protect life once a fetal heartbeat is detected. And I know that's not as aggressive as what a lot of people would like, but that shows to me that there is a commitment to protect life. So the question is, what can we do in addition to that? And I do think there may be some opportunities. At this point, what I think we ought to do, I think we need to see what the South Carolina Supreme Court does on the heartbeat law.
Right. And that should come out before the end of the year. I mean, we're hopeful that that decision will be released before the end of the year.
Yeah, that would be my expectation. Now, there's, you know, they don't announce when they're going to do it. It just drops whenever it comes. But I would think that they're not going to take too long on that. So I think let's see what the court does, and let's see what space there is that we can move. I mean, they could uphold heartbeat outright. They could. I hope they don't do this. They could strike it down entirely, and that would probably limit our ability to do much. But I think we need to see what the court does and what kind of guidance they give us in their opinion as to what they're willing to allow based on the state constitution. And I don't think the state constitution addresses this issue, so I don't think there really ought to be any type of adverse ruling from the court. But I don't know that everybody's going to agree with me on that. So
right.
I think let's see what the court does. And then I think based on that, then what I suggest is that we get some of the pro-life community members together. You get some legislators together, and let's see what we can come up with to move forward. Because I do think if the court gives us some space and you have the right approach, because the approach matters on this, man. I mean, how you push it, the rhetoric that gets used, those things matter in trying to win votes. And so I think if we come up with a good plan, similar to what we came up with heartbeat that passed last year, if we come up with a good approach and a plan, I think there may be an opportunity to do something positive. But we need to see first what the court says.
Yeah. Well, Senator, listen, you've given us 30 minutes today, and I really appreciate your time. For coming on the program today to help us kind of walk through that process from your vantage point. And we'll look forward in January to hopefully the court will rule in favor of the heartbeat bill. And once we hear from the court, then in January, I agree. I think we need to get together and do the best we can to protect life in South Carolina, because it just breaks my heart that we would be in the season when for so many years we worked to try to get Roe versus Wade, which we believe was a terrible law, terrible interpretation of the Constitution. We get it overturned, and South Carolina ends up being a 20-week abortion state. That just doesn't make any sense. So hopefully we can get that fixed.
That would be terrible.
Yeah.
And especially, you know, with the recent ruling out of Georgia, too, where their 6-week ban was knocked out. Of course, I think there's still some hope over there for that one. But
yeah, they're going to appeal. Attorney General said they're going to, you know, appeal that. So probably end up in their state Supreme Court. So, but Senator, thanks a lot, and happy Thanksgiving. And if I don't get to see you before then, a Merry Christmas for you and your family.
Same to you, Tony. I really appreciate that. I appreciate you letting me come on, and I enjoy your show. I listen to you online sometimes.
Well,
and
thank you.
Sometimes it's a day later, but I appreciate your work, and I really appreciate your ministry and your ability to reach so many people with the gospel.
Well, I tell you what, let's end up with a prayer. I want to pray for you and your family and your leadership. Father, I thank you for my brother. I thank you, God, for the gifts and abilities that you've given him. And I just pray that you continue to give him wisdom as he leads in the South Carolina Senate. I pray for his family, that you would protect them, provide for them. And Lord, just help us all in South Carolina as leaders to be able to come to a point where we can protect precious life in the womb, because I believe that that's what brings you honor and glory, and it's what's best for our society. In Jesus' name, amen. All right.
Thanks, Tony.
Yep, thanks again. In a minute here, we're going to talk about a really strange story in my mind that ran in the Washington Post on November 14th. A couple of guys at the Post, Josh Dossey and Delvin Barrett. I mean, there is a story behind this story as to why this ever made the light of day at the paper that it did, at the Washington Post, because they don't do anything over there that's not part of a broader narrative to undermine conservatives and promote progressives. So we're going to talk about it in just a minute. But first, we're going to talk to Philip over in Spartanburg. Hey, Philip. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Tony. First of all, yes, even when I was an unbeliever many, many years ago, I would never have thought to abort a child. I think that somehow this is a God-given thing that's wired into DNA. And if you don't get that, you never get it, especially in today's narcissistic, it's all about me world.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's my first point. Yeah, and second of all, what about, to me, an equal thing, or at least almost equal, and in my mind, since I'm a historian, this idea of promoting that your country is being taken over, that microphones are turned off, that people are deplatformed, that when you go to a college campus and somebody has the temerity to mention Jesus, their microphone goes dead. This, to me, if I was a Republican guy, I don't care who it is, I would get up there and say, listen, you are being taken over, your rights. You won't have any rights to do anything. We are so close to veering toward Marxism, totalitarianism. People in America, you know, they look at it on movies or, you know, and say, oh, that's a movie. That happened then with Hitler and all these people. Could never happen here. It is happening now. If I was a Republican candidate, that's what I would say. And if you say, well, how do you know who tells the truth? Very simple. Look at the one who tries to silence the other side. And those are the ones that are lying.
Yeah. Well, good points, Philip. I appreciate you making them, and I appreciate you listening to the show. Look, I don't have any argument with what you're saying. We're living in a very perilous time where, you know, even though we're not presently at war, we don't have a foreign enemy threatening to overtake us. Of course, actually we do in China, what's happening there, they have a detailed plan to replace the United States as a superpower and to mitigate our influence in the world and ultimately to overcome our country, I believe. But I'm talking about a direct threat, as in we've got enemies at the gates. You know, this should be a very good time in U.S. history where we can go about our business, pursue our dreams under the protection of the Bill of Rights and the United States Constitution. And yet we find those rights being undermined by a major political party. I mean, progressives, I don't think every Democrat wants to overthrow the Constitution and replace it with some kind of woke document. I don't think every Democrat wants that. But every Democrat needs to understand that the leadership of their party, the people who are driving the decisions, the people who are leading the charge, are definitely in that camp. They want to silence their critics. They want to come after people who don't agree. Instead of trying to win a debate, they want to silence the voices that would disagree with anything that they put out there. And that's happening. I mean, we talked about this story about Paul Pelosi. I mean, why can't we get to the bottom of that? I don't know what happened. And that's my point. I don't think any of us know for sure what happened in the Pelosi mansion that night, what really transpired. And we had a reporter at NBC who said, here's some additional information. This came from the police report. This came from the police. And he disappears. Nothing else on Twitter. He's suspended. The story's taken down. No explanation is given. And then those on the left wonder why we see this and begin to ask questions about our liberties. I mean, if people are going to behave in a totalitarian way, then we have to assume that totalitarianism is on the agenda. So, okay. I was trying to remember where I heard this quote the first time. I've heard it several times now, but it's just it's a very good one. You know, if you don't have a seat at the table, then you're probably on the menu. And that's, I think Christians need to remember that once our seat at the table is removed, then we will be among those who are discarded by the people in society who get to make the laws and make the rules. And the only thing standing between Christians, let me back up. God is sovereign, and our future and our blessings and our everything about us is not at the mercy of the federal government or anybody for that matter. The things that we believe can't be taken from us. They can only be surrendered by us. I mean, if the things we believe, if the government comes after us and we stand firm, even if we have to suffer persecution, we don't give up the things that are most important. Our belief in God, our belief in His Word, our belief in what God has said about life and about culture and about sexuality and about marriage and about all these things, about the precious nature of life. We hold firm to those things and realize that we're now living in a world, we're living in a culture where holding firm to those things may mean that we have to pay a price. Could be we pay the price of losing our job. Could be we pay the price of being ostracized on social media. Big deal to me. Could be we pay the price of not being able to get a loan at the bank if we don't line up with the bank's view of social justice. It may mean, you know, as we get further and further down this road, I mean, I don't want to hasten or jump to conclusions, but, you know, the book of Revelation does speak of a day when those who have or who are following Jesus Christ will not be able to buy or sell. Well, we're not there, okay? I don't want anybody to think that I'm suggesting that we've arrived at that location. But the groundwork is being laid today for a world in which Christians will be so far out of the mainstream that you can imagine, we couldn't imagine that before, but we can imagine now in the atmosphere that we have today, a world where people who are followers of Jesus Christ are excluded from society to the point that they can't buy or sell. I mean, I don't think that's, for anybody who pays attention, that's not an impossible place for us to land. All right. Philip, thanks for the call. Got me off on kind of a little bit of a rant there. But if you're the Washington Post and you're sort of the drum beater for the progressive agenda, then it would seem that you would want to see President Trump prosecuted for possessing classified documents at Mar-a-Lago, and that you would like to see a guilty verdict and have him end up serving some kind of jail time. Or would you? Here's the story that I'm talking about. Investigators see ego, not money, as Trump's motive on classified papers. Now, before we get into this, let's remember Hillary Clinton had classified information on her server, and it was open to outside attack. I mean, in terms of people could hack in, it was an unsecure server, at least not secure by government standards. So the decision about whether to prosecute her came down to her intent. Even though the law doesn't require that intent be part of an element of any crime or any violation of the law, especially when it comes to sensitive documents, doesn't matter what they intended if they broke the law. But the standard has been set. The precedent has been set by the Justice Department that if you really didn't mean to do anything nefarious, then we're not going to bring any charges against you. We're going to say that you were foolish and imprudent and careless with your handling of these documents, but since you weren't selling them to the Russians or the Chinese, we're going to give you a pass. That's essentially what was said to Hillary Clinton. So now we fast forward to Donald Trump. And we have this story. Federal agents and prosecutors have come to believe former President Donald Trump's motive for allegedly taking and keeping classified documents was largely his ego and a desire to hold on to the materials as trophies or mementos, according to people familiar with the matter. Skip a paragraph. The review that has been conducted has not found any apparent business advantage to the types of classified information in Trump's possession, these people said. Now, these are anonymous sources, of course. You know, the old caveat, these are people who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss, because they were not authorized to discuss an ongoing investigation. So these are leakers to the Washington Post. But first of all, why leak this? I mean, Does this make Trump look better or worse? I mean, obviously, if it could be proven that he was holding out some of these documents because, as it's been suggested, he wanted to make money by selling secrets to the Russians or to the Chinese, then that's something that the American people would, if that was proven or even insinuated to a point that a lot of people believed it, that could be very damaging to the president, even with some among his base, if they were to believe it. So why leak this story that says, you know, this all comes down to this. The president thought those documents belonged to him, and he wanted to keep them as mementos of him being in the White House. Does that sound like something the Justice Department is going to want to file charges over? I mean, if you were Merrick Garland, I have great problems with Merrick Garland and I know there are people that are calling. I read an article at the Federalist today. People are calling for the first thing that the House Republicans have to do is impeach Merrick Garland. That is insane. Okay? Hey, do I want Merrick Garland in office? No, I do not. Do we have the ability to get him out of office through impeachment? No, we do not. The Senate is in the control of Democrats, okay? We have a bare minimum majority in the House, enough to control the committees and launch investigations if that's what we want to do, but not enough for impeachment. I mean, but that's going to be successful. I mean, If Republicans waste their time for 2 years impeaching Biden, this Federalist went on to, the person at the Federalist was writing, went on to say, let's impeach Biden, let's impeach Mayorkas, let's have endless investigations of this. And look, I'm in favor of investigating Hunter Biden and the connections that Hunter Biden has to China, to Ukraine, to other places, because I think that there's a money stream that connects to the president. And that's a big enough deal that needs to be revealed. So if we're going to investigate something, let's investigate that and then stay away from all this other stuff that has absolutely no possibility of bearing fruit. But anyway, back to this story. So if President Trump didn't have any nefarious motivation in holding these documents, it's just his ego. He just, in fact, there's a place here, several Trump advisors that said each time he was asked to give documents or materials back, his stance hardened and that he gravitated toward lawyers and advisors who indulged his more pugilistic desires. Wow. Washington Post, right? Pugilistic desire. In other words, he wanted to fight. He wanted to find people that were willing to say, well, you can have these documents, because he wants what he wants and he wants it now. Trump repeatedly said the materials were his, not the government's, often in profane terms. Two of these people said, can I hear that? Oh, you betcha. Yeah, I could hear what President Trump would say about those documents. But here's the thing. I'm not going to necessarily read any more about this, because this is the point of the story. They're laying groundwork, I believe, for Merrick Garland to not charge him with a crime. They want him to be the nominee for the Republican Party. They want to run against Donald Trump because they believe that he's a loser. Now, this could backfire against him. It could really be, because if he gets the nomination and wins the White House, Democrats are going to just be inconsolable. But I can't see this any other way. Why does the Washington Post run this story, and why does somebody leak this information? I think there are conversations going back and forth between the White House and the Attorney General's office and the Democrat Party, where they're all kind of talking about the fact, well, now what's going to be best for the party? I don't think anybody gives a rip about what the law says here in this particular case. I think what they care about is how this is going to play out politically. And so they're maybe calculating now, okay, maybe the more we go after Trump with the government, the more it solidifies his base, but it could hurt him with independents and the people that he would need to get the nomination. And so maybe we want him to get the nomination. Let's give Merrick Garland some rope here, some slack in the rope, so that he'll have a path where he cannot bring charges. And we let Trump declare victory, and we let him romp to the Republican nomination, and then we stomp him in the 2024 presidential election. I think that's what they think. Now, they could be dead wrong. They've been wrong about Trump. The media and the people who are Trump detractors have often been wrong about him. They've written him off, and he just keeps coming back. But I really believe that's what's up here. I can't figure out any other reason that why the Washington Post would embrace this, because it helps Trump in a way. Now, maybe they think it's in a condescending way, it makes him look bad because of his ego and thinking that those documents are his. But believe me, that is not adding to the possibility of a prosecution, because the Justice Department is not going to want to prosecute President Trump over something that looks petty. They're going to want something substantial. And it seems to me they're trying to pull the rug out from under that. We'll have to see how all that plays out. I don't know what's going to... You've got all these stories about these big donors coming out and they're not going to support Trump anymore. You've got polls out there showing that significant portions of the Republican Party are saying it's time to move on. Can I just don't believe that, okay? Right now, President Trump is a formidable candidate. He's got the upper hand at the moment, because he's got the name recognition. He's been president of the United States. He's considered by many to be the leader of the Republican Party. But, you know, these Democrats, and I ridiculed them. I ridiculed Democrats that were spending money in Republican primaries to promote Trump-backed candidates. I said that was going to come back to bite them. All eight of those candidates lost. All eight of the candidates that Democrats spent money to get so they'd be an opponent of a Democrat in the general election, they lost. We need to think about these things when we're thinking about who the leader of the Republican Party is going to be and whether or not they're going to be able to win the presidency in 2024. All right, that's all the time we've got for today. Tomorrow will be Backpatting Day. We'll talk to Senator Josh Kimbrell tomorrow as on our regular schedule. And, of course, we'll take your telephone calls and look forward to it. God bless you. Have a great day.